The following message, Worldview Theology Part 1, was delivered to the adult Bible class of Emmanuel Reformed Baptist Church of Seatac, Washington, on Sunday, October 30th, 2016, by Pastor Bart Carlson of Trinity Baptist Church, Montville, New Jersey.
Well, as we continue looking at this topic of a Christian worldview, We've come to the end of the introductory material, which I sought to set out a number of basic foundational principles, address some of the challenges to us. But I want to come back and just set the framework as we then come to begin the first unit, again using the material from Understanding the Times from the Summit Ministries. Let's see, where's my? There's that water. I don't need it. This is a very shallow pulpit. There we go. So I'm using their material, but to cull out some things and set the stage for what we're going to look at. Remember, we said a worldview is a way in which we look at all of the world, a framework of perspectives, basic assumptions, ideas that shape the way that we relate to one another, relate to the world around us, relate to ourselves, understand ourselves. Everybody has one, maybe called something different. It's become the common buzzword, especially in Christian circles, to speak of a worldview. But it's just that basic framework. You can call it what you like, different words are used for it. But what in this course seek to do is to set out some of those basic worldviews that have shaped American thinking in particular. Right, so we're looking at basically Western thought, Western civ, if you will. And so there were six worldviews. Can anybody, as we name those six worldviews, somebody give me, besides Christianity, that's one. What are the others?
Liberalism,
okay. Now, from a Christian standpoint or from a political standpoint? Okay. All right. Liberalism. Okay, that definitely is one of the main, I would say, especially within Christianity, you've got liberalism, which takes a different view of Scripture, different view of God, different view of salvation. You've got liberalism within the political sphere, which has a particular bent toward what's important and what's their direction. But what stands behind some of those perspectives? Let's some of the other major worldviews.
Materialism.
Okay, materialism. Now we're getting into philosophy here, right? So philosophy speaks of materialism or naturalism, right? It's one of the basic philosophies. What's the other theistic worldview in America?
Islam,
right? So we have this influence of Christianity and now a growing influence of Islam, a second theistic worldview, right? I heard somebody say something else, atheism, right? We're going to come to that in a little bit. But that's a category, that's a description of a particular category. So let me give you some of those. Secular humanism, right, which is a package that deals with a worldview and how things all fit together. We'll look at it as one of the six main worldviews. Third one is Marxism and Leninism. So we have Christianity, Islam, secular humanism, Marxism and Leninism. And if you think Marxism is dead, it's just gone by a different name. Now it's often called liberalism or socialism, and different characters in these different categories. But Marxism is still very much alive, especially on college campuses. Right? So can anybody think of two others that are probably the more esoteric in American thinking, anyway?
Pantheism.
Okay, we're going to come to that. We're looking at one of the subcategories. Who would believe pantheism? That'd be a theistic or a view of theology for what kind of group? They sell pyramids and they used to... what's that?
New Age,
right. New Age, or what's called in this book New Spirituality or Cosmic Humanism, right? And then the last one, which is the one which is probably most prevalent in much of American culture today, is Postmodernism. Right. So here's our six worldviews. Christianity, Islam, secular humanism, Marxism, the cosmic humanism, and postmodernism. And these are some of the major categories, major worldviews that we deal with on a regular basis. Now, within those categories, within those various worldviews, we have 10 categories or 10 disciplines that we're going to look at, should we ever get through all this material over the next 40 years or however long I'm able to still keep coming and you keep inviting me back. So the next 10 categories, right, the 10 categories under each of those, we have the foundational one, which we're going to look at today, is theology. And each one of them has a theology. They have a view of God or non-God, right? Some of those have been mentioned. The next one after that is philosophy, which describes the major questions in life and answers those major questions. So what's the purpose of life? Why are we here? Where are we going? How do we know what we know? What is true? So that's philosophy. And then under philosophy, we have a category called ethics, and that's how do we discern or determine what's right and what's wrong. Within under that, then we'll have a category called biology, and biology basically addresses a lot of different things. Some of it's anthropology, the doctrine of man. Much of it has to do with origins, because that's a major topic in culture today as well. Where did we come from? So you have biology. After biology, you have something called psychology, which is another part of anthropology, or the study of man, in which we're dealing with what makes up man and why does man do what man does. Then after that, there's something called sociology. So after those basic individual categories, we come to a category of sociology where we start to talk about how we relate to one another. And the rest of the categories all in some sense focus on how we relate to one another. So how do we organize as people? Then under sociology, we have something called law. Law is then how do we govern those people? What are the laws and rules that govern that those social structures? Then there's politics, in which we get into governmental structure and governmental policy. And then after that, we have history. I think I've got all 10 categories there. If I missed one, you don't know, because unless you were writing down, you didn't get all 10. Anyway, but those are the 10 categories, right? So the last one is history. History then takes a big step back in one sense and doesn't look so much at any one of the particular social structures or how we relate to one another, but how is time moving? Where did it begin, or was there a beginning? Does it have a pattern in which it's flowing, and does it have a goal to which it's going? Right, and that's what we look at when we look at the topic of history. And all of these worldviews, each of these different categories that we've looked at, have perspectives that fit into each of these different categories, each of these different boxes. And so some time ago I gave out a worldview chart, which looks something like, you saw something like this, right, which had those six views across the top and the 10 different categories. Oh, I missed one. There was. It's economics. That was the one I missed. Economics goes right before history. And that's both personal economics and then economics at a social level, but more primarily at a social level. So that kind of, you can see that all these little boxes get filled in. This is material directly from Summit Ministry and their chart, and it's a very helpful chart. If you go to their website, summit.org, go under resources, you'll see worldview chart, and you can actually click on any one of these boxes and get a fuller description of what each one of these means. So today, we take up the first of these categories, and we won't by any means go in depth into them, but we're going to take up this first category called theology. Now, I assert, and I believe can be shown to be true, that theology is the foundation of every worldview. Every worldview has a theology. Now, that theology may be what is called atheism, in which we'll look at in a minute what that definition is, but this is the foundation of it all. So it's foundational place. As we have the battle for ideas, as we said, this was what's involved in worldviews, is we're in a battle for ideas. This is the big idea. Does God exist or doesn't he? Theology, for the purpose of what we're studying today, is narrowly described as the study of God. Now, theology has a broader term, right? When we talk about theology, we can talk about the whole of systematic theology and the various doctrines that are taught, or we can look at biblical theology and talk about the history of God and redemption. But here we're going to talk specifically about the doctrine of God. And you take the Greek words that make up theology, theos, logos, the study of God is basically what the word means. So that's what we're looking at in this particular band or this particular discipline. This is not merely a topic for seminarians. It's not just something that's really dry and we should all just go home and say, oh, let's leave Pastor Carlson and his seminary background to think about that. You are theologians, whether you want to or not. There's a book out on the broader scale that talks of, that's written by a woman for women about how women should be theologians too. And really, there's nobody that shouldn't be a theologian in the broader sense in terms of understanding biblical doctrine. But in a narrow sense, all of us are theologians. We have some view about what we think is true about something or someone called God. The existence or non-existence of God affects everything a person believes or does. For if God exists, and again, we have to define the term, don't we? We have to even define what God means, but we'll come to that in a minute. If God exists, and he is that supreme being to whom I have a responsibility to give account, that's going to affect the way I do things. If that God is something that I have just made up in my own mind and just kind of frame and have over here to make me feel comfortable, as we saw with the moralistic, therapeutic deism, he's just a God to kind of step in when I need some help and is going to be my therapist when I need a therapist, and he's going to be my cuddly bear when I need a cuddly bear. If that's all that God is and he's just something I've made up in my mind, well, then it's not going to affect me when I go to work. It's going to affect me when I have problems. If God really doesn't exist, then I have to then look for something else to be supreme, something else to give a sense of, well, how do I know what's the purpose in my life and the reason for living? There's going to be something or someone who holds a position of being the ultimate authority in our lives. It's always going to be there. Somebody or something is going to have the ultimate authority in our lives. And for some people, that's, well, let me ask you, what are some of the things that people have as the ultimate authority in their lives that reject God? Self, in many different ways. What else?
Science.
Science, right? Science gives us all the answers. Science will answer every question that we have. What else?
Family,
right? So I might look at the social structures and the social dynamics within my present home. This is going to define everything, and family is going to be ultimate. Now, we often shift these things, don't we? People often make shifts. They say, okay, well, I start here, where it's self, I get married, now it becomes family. And I live for that being ultimate. Humanity is another one. Not man, a person, self in particular, but humanity in general. And we find our ultimate purpose and ultimate answers to questions by looking at humanity and doing a poll or a search of what humanity says. Philosophy, the study of philosophy, is also a place that has something else that has become an ultimate decision maker for people. So these are some of the things that come into play when we start talking about theology. Now, in the six worldviews, there are three basic approaches to theology. Right? This is point number two. We looked at the foundational place. Second thing, let's look at these six basic worldviews. There are three basic approaches to theology. Three basic approaches to theology. They've all been mentioned, right? Theism. There is a God that exists outside of ourselves, that is greater than us. And that's the worldviews of Christianity and Islam. But we still have to ask the question, okay, well, what is God? We have to ask the question, well, who is this God? What is he like? Can he be known? If he's known, how is he known? These are all the questions that one has to ask if they're going to hold to a theistic worldview. Some of the questions that people use to deny a theistic worldview, because they don't find that the answers satisfy them. Second worldview, or second view of God, is our basic approach to theology, is atheism. Literally, atheism, the no theism, no belief in a God, is one way that that's defined. And this is what, atheism is the belief that there is no God, or no belief in a God. So this is found in secular humanism, or what is often called just plain humanism. And I think I've mentioned in here that if you use the word humanism, it's generally thought of in terms of this category of naturalistic, materialistic, anti or atheistic view of the world. That's what secular humanism is, but it's used humanism. I use the word humanism to mean a belief in humans, and I'm a humanist, but I'm a Christian humanist. I have a concern for people. I have a love for humanity. I have a love for individuals. And that's my view of humanism. That's basically what the word means, to believe in humans. But it's used to mean humans as though they were the beginning, middle, and end of all things. Then there's Marxism, which also is atheistic, whether it's the view of China or the Marxism of one of the other communist countries in Asia or Russia. That's the Marxism and Leninism. And then there's postmodernism, which is also an atheistic worldview. There is no God. Now, there's something... let me just stay with my notes. Humanism is generally understood to be incompatible with a belief in God. There's just no possibility that there is a God who exists. There's something called the New Atheism. It's a new resurgence or outspoken atheism. People like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Bennett, Christopher Hitchens, who died in 2011. And this new atheism, just looking at several of the various things, I've watched at least one video with Christopher Hitchens. I've watched a video with Richard Dawkins. And this quote would be true with what I've seen so far and what I've heard so far. And what others have said, the quote is, there is little new about new atheism except this, it is quite brash. In the sense that they, I believe it was a quote from Richard Dawkins that I read quote from Richard Dawkins is that Christianity, religion in particular, not just Christianity, but religion in general, is to be vehemently criticized, condemned, and opposed. They make statements about the fact that religion, and particularly Christianity, is not just something that a few people that shouldn't be listening to it actually hold to, but it's something which is detrimental to society and ought to be opposed and eliminated. Now, there are statements that make it very clear that Christianity in particular, and especially, is viewed with contempt. So there's not only the denial of the existence of God, there is a vehement criticizing and condemning and opposing of religion and in Christianity in particular. I was looking online at a website that I found, an atheist website, and a couple statements that were made about what atheism is, and one person made it very clear, atheism is not a belief system. And I just want to ask that person, do you believe that to be true? Of course they believe that to be true. It is a belief system, and they're trying to distance themselves from the standpoint of making it somehow that theism has imposed this thing called belief on people. No, we all believe things. We all act based on presuppositions and assumptions. We may test them in different ways. Some of them we never test. We just take on the word of somebody else. We just live by them. We all do that. That's how humans exist. But this person was trying to make it clear it was not a belief system. Another person said that atheism was actually a rejection of theism. Now, that's a very interesting perspective to take. It's not just I don't believe in God, it's I reject the fact that there's any can be any belief in God. And again, it just has a little more direct approach toward this idea of theism. Agnosticism is also fits in this category of atheism, and many who would consider themselves atheists would also put themselves in the category of agnostics, either philosophically, because they say you can't prove a negative. We can't prove that God doesn't exist. And so therefore we just kind of say, well, we don't think there's enough evidence to say he does exist. And so, or there are those who are a little more... further away from the atheism and just would really lay themselves in the agnostic. I just can't know. I just can't know for sure, and I'm just not certain, and so I'm not willing to commit one way or the other. And so that's the second way of second approach to theism or to theology. There's theism, the belief in the existence of a god or gods. Christianity and Islam are two of those. Atheism, the belief that there is no god or no belief in a god. And the third is pantheism. Pantheism fits in with cosmic humanism or New Age or New Spirituality. That's their view of God, and their view is everything is God. Or God is in everything and somehow a part of everything. And that's the third approach to this teaching of theology. So those are the three ways we can see theology in these worldviews. Can anybody think of any others or any questions thus far about any of those things that we've seen, or that I've mentioned, I should say? Any other worldviews? There's some in a pantheistic worldview who like to say, well, you know, there's always got to be a third category. We can't have this dualism. There's either God or no God. We've got to have this third category, so we've got to have something that kind of sits in the middle. And as Ravi Zacharias asked one of the people who believe this, that said, oh, so what you're saying is there are those who believe in this third way and there's those who don't. And the man scratched his head and said, yeah, this dualism is kind of hard to get away from, isn't it? Yeah, A and not A is always going to be a very difficult thing to get away from. It's a logical logical statement that, you know, if you have A, you can't have not A. If you have not A, you can't have A. And if they're both existent, then there's some talking needs to be done to try to make those two things fit, because maybe there's just a matter of we're really not negating or we're doing something else there. But pantheism is kind of an effort to find that middle ground for a place for God. So the question then that we come to in the third place, and probably the most important question that we face, is how do we know God? How do we know God? If God does exist, and I'm unashamedly a Christian here and teaching a Christian worldview, so I will be, you know, setting that out as the primary focus here. But how do we know that this God exists? We're developing our worldview, so you can understand why we believe what we believe. Well, probably the simplest answer to that question is study theology, right? Just start studying theology. Take up a theology book and start reading about God. Well, that's certainly one way, right? The study of the idea of God. God here, again, we have to ask the question, who is God? What is God? Now, I take the definition of God, that God is the supreme and ultimate being. Right? That's a fairly basic idea. He's the supreme, ultimate being. He's supreme in that he sits at the highest place. He's the ultimate authority. Everybody eventually answers to him. All things come under his direction and his control. At some point, he is at the top. There's no way around that. Not being general for purpose. It's just the general idea of what God is, who God is. But now, let me ask you, when you're studying in school, right? You're studying any topic, right? Math, chemistry, biology, electronics, medicine, pick a field, any field. What is your relationship to your subject? Where do you stand in relationship to your subject that you're studying? You biology students, okay, when you are doing a dissection, where do you stand in relationship to your study? It's not a difficult question. I ask the easy ones. Karen?
A desire to find truth.
Okay, a desire to find truth. Okay, that's the posture. But where do I stand in relationship to this? Colleen was telling me that they actually used cadavers. The frog or the perch or the crayfish. Where do you stand in relationship to it? Over it, really, right? Don't you? You're looking down on it. You're dissecting it. You're the one in charge. You're the one doing the seeking. You're the one who's dissecting it, right? You stand over your subject. You're looking into it. And you're looking down on it, working through it. right? When I study math, when I studied mathematics, or when you study one of the engineering sciences, what do you do? You're standing in a place. Now, maybe the topic is far greater than you understand, but you're standing, as it were, over it as the seeker of truth and the seeker of knowledge, seeking to understand it and grasp it, with the intent that somehow I can actually grasp this set of knowledge. Okay?
You're the authority as you're gathering the knowledge.
You're the authority as you're gathering. You're the gatherer. That's right. You're the one that stands over the top. You're doing the searching. Right? Now, I may have other people that I'm listening to. That's not the point. The point is, the subject I'm looking at, I'm the one who's doing the research. I am digging into the topic. I'm taking this stuff out. Now, when I talk about psychology, and a lot of secular humanists do not like the science of psychology. Can anybody think why they might not like that? What is one of the tenets of secular humanism? It was mentioned here a while ago. I think Rob mentioned it.
Materialism,
right? And what is materialism?
Matter is all that exists, and matter is the ultimate explainer.
All right.
We do everything how we're programmed to do it.
Right. All right, very good. So he's taken the materialism and he's worked that philosophy out into a few different areas. But psychology has no hard thing to lay hold of. It's called one of the soft sciences. Sociology is called a soft science. Why? Because you can look at societies, but you really, you're dealing with people. There's a video I've got on my to watch list. It's a TED video where one of these gentlemen, I believe it was Daniel Bennett, describes the idea of consciousness in a materialistic worldview and how to understand consciousness. But see, psychology is the study of the soul. By definition, that's what the word means. Suke, logos, the study of the soul. So how can a naturalist study the soul? Can't see the soul. Soul doesn't exist. A soul has to be defined as chemical things or something else. They have to come up with a way to describe that. So it becomes a very difficult thing. So when psychology, though, there's a difference. There's a difference in the study of psychology versus the study of other things. Psychologists deal with individuals. And in that sense, I'm no longer standing over the subject, but as Lars mentioned a little bit ago, I'm standing alongside of it, right? It's another human being that I'm relating to, that I'm trying to discern about them. I'm trying to discern and learn about people by interacting with the person. So psychology is a standing alongside in terms of trying to study. Sociology is standing within and trying to discern things around. But theology, where do we stand in relationship to our subject when we're studying theology? Well, if it's merely a sociological phenomenon, then I stand within the society and I just kind of look around and try to pull what's going on within society and try to figure out, okay, what is society saying? And that's how I determine what God is, and my study of God becomes merely a study of society rather than a study of God. But if I'm a theist and I believe in God, the supreme being, where do I stand in relationship to my subject? Under him. Right? I stand under him. So how do I then relate to him? Now, there's some sense in which I relate to him like I relate to other human beings, as I relate to human beings. That is, that I stand alongside of him in the sense of trying to interact with him. But when I talk about theology, I'm talking about a being that's transcendent. Right? Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. Anybody know what those verses say? Let's look those up real quick. Isaiah 55, 8 and 9. Maybe I'll have somebody read it in the Hebrew. And I'll let Stan read the Hebrew this morning and Colleen read the Greek. All right. Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. Right? My thoughts are not your thoughts. God is speaking here, begins through his prophet, verse 1. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. You who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money, without cost. He's talking as though he's a street vendor, and he's calling the people to come. You know, one of those guys down at the Pike's Place Market, they're calling you over, you know, come see my wares, come see what I have. And God is saying, come, come to me, buy and eat. But then in the midst of this, he tells the sinner to seek him, verse 6, seek the Lord while he may be found, call upon him while he is near. But then he describes himself in verse 8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, and my ways are not your ways, declares the Lord. Now, whether he's talking to the unbeliever, whether he's talking to any person who's hearing his voice, he goes on to say, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So how in the world do you know a being like that? Whose thoughts and ways are transcendent. That is, they exceed all of our personal comprehension and experience. How do you know a God like that? How would you even begin to know a God like that? Is a God like that knowable? To come back to liberalism that was mentioned earlier, can you know that God? Maybe he's just the so far out there we can't know him. Well, if you wanted to study psychology, how would you get to know your subject? Spend time with them, right? You have to spend time with people, talk to people, draw, have questions from people. You get to know them, right? How do we know anyone? Now, we could Google people, right? You've all done that, right? Gone and Googled your own name because you thought, I got to find out what people are knowing about me, right? I think I found one other Barton Carlson in the world. So, you know, you can Google it, but do you really know the person if you Google them? Let's say they're very, very unsecure in the way that they put information out on the internet. So you can gather all kinds of information about people. I recently found somebody I needed to find, and all I knew was the first name and the kind of job they had and a general area where they worked, and I was able to find the person. But I didn't know this person. I wouldn't have been able to pick this person out of a crowd. And maybe if they had a Facebook page, maybe I would have had a picture. But I don't know how old that picture is. So you can know about people, right? You can gather all kinds of information and know about them. And that's kind of the foundation or the beginning to knowing somebody. But that's not the same as knowing them, is it? How many of you know President Barack Obama? Nobody's going to put their hands up. Nobody wants to admit it. Right? You know a lot about him, don't you? You know some of his perspectives, his policies. You've seen his picture. You could pick him out of a crowd. Right? You know a lot about him, but you don't really know him. And the more time, if you wanted to know him, you'd have to interact with him. And even if you interacted with him, you ever interacted with somebody and then you came away going, I don't really think I know this person. That ever happened to you? It happens all the time, doesn't it? How can you get to know a person? Besides me asking their questions, what must that person do? They must talk. They must reveal themselves to me, right? They have to be willing to tell me things about themselves. So they have to reveal themselves to me. So if I'm going to know God, then how am I going to get to know him? He has to reveal himself to me. He has to reveal himself to me. And if he's the supreme being whose ways are higher than my ways and thoughts are higher than my thoughts, he's in the driver's seat as to how much I'm going to know him. And the more you get to know somebody, the more intimate you become with them. Same thing with God. The more you get to know him, the more intimate you become with him. So how do we get to know God? We can study theology, but we really have to look for him to reveal himself to us. Verse 10, if you're still open in Isaiah 55, kind of hints at that. Verses 10 and 11. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so will my word, verse 11, be which goes forth from my mouth. It will not return to me empty without accomplishing what I desire and without succeeding in the matter for which I sent it. The God that we want to know is a God who has revealed himself. And if he hadn't revealed himself, we wouldn't know him. There's no possibility of knowing him. So in order to know God, we need to study the idea of God. But we need to do more than that. We need to study what this God has given to us in revealing himself to us. Now, let me ask you this. How has God revealed himself to us?
Through his word.
Through creation. Anything else?
Conscience.
What's that? Same thing, right? Okay, conscience. What else?
History.
Through his son Jesus Christ. Right? So he has revealed himself in numerous ways, right? Can you prove that from the Bible? Now, can you prove that from the Bible? I'm just going to assume the Bible is the primary source of revelation, but can we prove from the Bible that it's a source of revelation? And can we prove from the Bible that creation is a source of revelation of God?
Yes.
Now, can you? This is class. I'm putting it out to you. Where would you look?
Romans
what?
One.
Romans 1. Okay? We'll come there in just a minute. Romans 1, verses 18 and following. We'll come to that in just a second. There's another passage in the Old Testament. Psalm 19. Thank you. All right, let's turn to Psalm 19. Let's begin there. Now, you don't have to open up the Bible very far to realize it's the book. One of the ways to summarize the purpose of our Bibles is that it is a self-revelation of God. Right? From Genesis 1 to Revelation 22, it is a revelation of God. Starts right off at the beginning. In the beginning, God. Right, but the psalmist, looking at the world, describes for us what James Montgomery Boyce has called God's two books. God's two books of revelation. So let's just read. I'll read Psalm 19. Follow along and just look for again this various aspects of revelation. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their utterance to the ends of the world. In them he has placed a tent for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chambers. He rejoices as a strong man to run his course. Its rising is from one end of the heavens, and its circuit to the other end of them. And there is nothing hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandments of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true. They are righteous altogether. They are more desirable than gold, yes, than much fine gold, sweeter also than honey and the drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Acquit me of hidden faults. Also, keep back your servant from the presumptuous sins. Let them not rule over me. Then I will be blameless, and I shall be acquitted of great transgressions. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. So, if just looking at this, what are the verses that talk about the two ways we know God, the two books? What's the first one? Verse 1 to verse what? Verse 1 to verse 6, right? God's big picture book. Right? It doesn't get much bigger than this. He's talking about the heavens and the sun running through the heavens. And he talks about them as those who speak. Verse 2, day to day pours forth speech. And night to night reveals knowledge. But then he says, there is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. What does that mean? Is there speech or isn't there speech? There is speech. In what sense is there no speech? It's not audible. It's not with words, right? It's pictures. The sun. You see the sun coming up in the morning, going down at night. What does that tell you? God's been faithful. Again, the sun has come up and the sun has gone down. The seasons come and go. What does that tell you? God is faithful to His covenant promises, right? Genesis chapter 8. Seed time and harvest, summer and winter. Cold and heat, they come and they go according to God's order. Anybody ever get amazed at the fact that spring always follows winter? You know, I'd kind of like it to go fall, spring, fall, spring, fall, spring, fall, spring. You know, maybe a little summer in the middle there. I like it, a little occasional snow, but let's keep that kind of, you know, but it doesn't go that way, right? It's always the same order. And you can go to different climates, different places on the globe, and you can pretty much, you can begin to predict what the climate's going to be like. Why? Because it's orderly. Because, again, it's been revealed to us that God keeps an order to this world, so He's being faithful. So we learn about Him. Now, this particular passage tells us that the heavens are telling us that God exists and He's glorious. Right? That's the message. That's the primary message that the sun gives us every single day when it runs its course. And there's nowhere in the world where that message is not heard. Can't hide from the sun. You can go down a cave, but ultimately there's the effects of the sun and the reality of the sun that covers the earth. So God's big picture book, and we could go elsewhere, we could see other places where it talks about creation declaring to us that God exists. Right, we'll come to that in just a minute. So this is the first one, God's big picture book. And then the other one, if I can put it this way, is God's little storybook. Now, storybook not in the sense of fictional stories, but storybook in the sense of narrative and description. Now, that seems like a pretty big book when you count, 1,300 pages. Right? But the fact of the matter is, when you compare that to creation, that's a pretty small book. Pretty small book. And in this book, we have God's law, right? The second half of the psalm, beginning at verse 7, going down to the end. Now, tell me, what's the difference between the first half of the psalm and the second half of the psalm and the revelation of God that is seen in the first half versus the revelation seen in the second half?
Well, it's words in the second half.
Okay, it's words. Okay? So much more revelation, right? More detail, more clarity. What else?
It's more personal.
How do you get that?
Well, the first part is remote. You're looking at something outside us. And now it's restoring the soul.
Okay. Excellent. So one is from outside us. It's coming to us. We'll come back to that in a sense. But another sense, and this is much more personal, it's actually interacting with us and affecting us. Right? This second one is not only personal, but look at all that it does for us. What amazing things the Word of God can do. It can restore the soul. It can make the simple wise. It can rejoice the heart. It can enlighten the eyes. It directs in terms of righteousness. It gives direction forever. It's more valuable than gold. If you listen to its warnings, you get great reward. Right, so all of this comes from this little book. So these two forms of revelation, but one has more information in it and more specific information, personal information that actually affects, daily affects us, right, in a way that the other doesn't. Now the other should affect us, right, but this is more direct and more personal. And then notice how he ends. What do we learn from verse 14? Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. What do we learn with regard to revelation of God from that verse? We're accountable to Him, right? This one, David's praying this. He's thinking about God's words that have come to him. And he says, my mouth and my thoughts, you're aware of those things and I'm accountable to you for those. And Look what he tells us about God with that little phrase at the end, my rock and my redeemer. Not to mention Yahweh. Yahweh, my rock and my redeemer. What incredible description there is and information there is in those few words about this God. Now, you can look at creation all you want, and you will never learn from looking at the trees, however beautiful the colors become, that Yahweh is your Redeemer. You'll never learn that. You can't learn that apart from the book, apart from God's book. Now let's go over to Romans chapter 1. That was the other passage that was mentioned, another key passage here. Romans chapter 1. In verse 18, we read there, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what was made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them, for they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural, and in the same way also the men abandoned the natural function of the women and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, as being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanders, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. So what do we learn here about God's revelation of Himself?
God rules.
God rules. Right? How do we know that?
He judges.
He judges. All right? What else can we glean from this passage?
It's enough to hold man guilty.
It's enough to, what's enough to hold man guilty?
Revelation of creation.
All right. Revelation of creation is enough to hold man guilty and accountable to God. What can we know about God from creation according to this verse? These verses.
His power,
His power and His divine Godhead. We can actually come to awareness through creation that God exists and that He is very powerful. What else? And we're also accountable to Him. That was the other thing. It's very clear. And He rules. Anything else? Is that knowledge a vague knowledge? According to the passage. How well can we know God in creation?
Enough to know we should honor Him.
Enough to know we should honor Him, right? Enough to be accountable to Him. But notice what verse 19 says. Because that which is known about God is evident within them. It is evident, clear, for God made it evident to them. The knowledge in creation is evident. It's not fuzzy. It's clear. God exists. That's what the Bible says. That's what God has revealed to us. All men know God exists. For since the creation of the world, and there we learn something about biology and cosmology. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes. How can you know something that's invisible? Well, when it reveals itself, right? When Mr. Invisible puts on a glove and his glove starts, you say, okay, there, I see his hand. Right? His invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine godhood or nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through that which was made, so that they are without excuse. And how is that made known? Or how does that manifest itself? That they reject that. It says, well, they don't honor him as God. They don't give thanks to him as God. They exchange his order of things for other things. They exchange the glory of the incorruptible God and worship the creature rather than the creator. Creature becomes number one, whether it's man or humanity or science or something else that takes the place of God. They exchange that. He goes on to say in verse 25 that that's exchanging the truth of God for a lie. They worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. So we learn something about the fact that there's a creator in and behind all this. But I want you to see, again, from a biblical worldview, from a biblical Christian worldview, we can know God. Matter of fact, everyone knows God. But we can actually know him even fuller than just what we see in creation, because he has revealed himself to us through his word. Now, somebody mentioned conscience. Well, verse 32 speaks of conscience. Because what is conscience? Conscience is part of what? Is it part of God's word, or is it part of creation? Creation. Are you part of creation? Yes. You are constantly testifying to yourself that God exists. Because everything in you, in one way or another, reflects the nature, the character of God. Now, why is it so difficult to read creation? If it's so clear and so evident, why is that so hard? And by the way, doesn't that put a different picture on Genesis chapter 1 and what Adam did when he was working in the garden? He wasn't just being a farmer to produce food for him to eat. He was learning about his God, the order of his God, the structure of his God, the wisdom of his God, the kindness of his God, the power of his God. And as he was going about creation, he's digging all this up and he's being hit with that. But why is it? Why is it that creation is so hard for people to read?
Because we're fallen. We suppress the truth.
Okay, because we're fallen. So we have the wrong pair of glasses on. And so we're reading it wrong.
Well, and we don't want to. We don't want to see it, but then we're accountable to somebody.
We don't want to see it because we don't want to be accountable. Because we are accountable, right? Our conscience tells us that. If we read down to chapter 2, we'll come to this if we ever get to ethics, chapter 2, verses 12 and following, we come to see how God has woven creation, Sinai, and the judgment day all together with us by our conscience. And all of that comes to focus on our conscience, else either excusing or accusing us. And so our conscience is constantly saying, so what do? We have to suppress that. Suppress that. And in what way do we suppress it, according to the passage? In unrighteousness. Psalm 10. I've referred to this many times. There's no fear of God before your eyes, their eyes. Psalm 14. There's no thought of God. Why? They're suppressing it because of the wickedness, the sin that they want to live. Now, that's what the passage says. So it's unclear, not because God made it unclear, because God clearly revealed himself, but because we have the wrong set of glasses on, and because what else was affected by the fall?
Our conscience.
Our conscience and
creation.
Right? Everything around us is affected by the fall. And so, in that sense, therefore, it's not the clearest description and revelation of the God that we want to know and love. Or that we're supposed to know and love. Let me put it that way. We're supposed to know and love. It's not because we're looking at it wrong and because it's been affected by sin too. Now, would God have been kind to leave man in that state? No. He would have been just. Would have been just. But he did more than that. Right? He spoke to us through his word. He spoke to us through his word. Why? So that we could know him to be our rock and our redeemer. Yahweh makes covenant, keeps covenant. Right? Now there's one other aspect of revelation which was noted here. What's the clearest revelation of the glory of God? Christ. Where is that found?
Hebrews 1.
That's right. Let's look to Hebrews 1. Hebrews 1. We've been digging around Hebrews 1. And here it clearly comes to light where God tells us how he has revealed himself to us. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in or by the prophets in many portions and in many ways. So he spoke to the prophets in many ways. Sometimes it was an audible voice. Sometimes it was a measure of ecstasy. Sometimes it was a picture. Sometimes it was a vision. In these last days has spoken to us in his Son. Oh, here's revelation. He's spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And here's the phrase, and he, that is Jesus, is the radiance of his glory, the exact representation of his nature. I think it's a very good translation. New American Standard, I think, gets the closest to what I believe Pastor Robert Martin called out for us from this passage in his book on Hebrews. And if you read anything, just read this chapter when his book comes out, that you read about these things right here. Because this is amazing. God spoke to his people in times past through visions, through audible voices, ecstasy, but he's spoken to us through his Son. And his Son, there was no sin in him. So there was no hindrance to the revelation coming forth. He is the exact representation of his nature. He is the outshining of his glory, the radiance of his glory. This is what God has done to reveal himself to us. John chapter 1, verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. 1:18, why did he come? He came to exegete, to make known to us the Father. So he could say to Philip, have you not known me? If you have seen me, you've seen the Father. Not because I and the Father are the same being in different modes, but because I perfectly represent the Father. His will, his purposes, his character. He's the exact representation of his nature. This is what God has done, that we might know him. He's not left us without a word. He hasn't left us in the dark. He's made it very clear. Now, does that mean that we as Christians should not like science or be against science? No. No, man, we gotta love science. Why? Because science tells us more and more about the God we love. The order, his power, his divine character, his wisdom, his beauty. We learn more and more about God. But without this book and without his Son, we may know something about him, but we cannot know him. For this is eternal life. They may know you, Jesus said, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. So what a blessing for us that God has revealed himself to us in his word. Well, Next time we come together, we'll talk a little bit more about the distinctives of the Christian theism, and then, Lord willing, move on to some of the Islam and other aspects of their and the theologies of other worldviews. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for your word. Thank you for kindly revealing yourself to us. Thank you for so kindly coming by in your Son to reveal your heart to us and your salvation to us and your character to us. Please be merciful to open our eyes that we might see clearly who you are and honor you as the God whom you are. Give you the honor that is due to your name. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.